an intransigent devotion to the pursuit of truth, Miss Taggart? Have you heard the moralists and the art lovers of the centuries talk about the artist's intransigent devotion to the pursuit of truth? Name me a greater example of such devotion than the act of a man who says that the earth does turn, or the act of a man who says that an alloy of steel and copper has certain properties which enable it to do certain things that it is and does. And let the world rack him or ruin him, he will not bear false witness to the evidence of his mind. This Miss Taggart, this sort of spirit, courage, and love for truth, as against a sloppy bum who goes around proudly assuring you that he has almost reached the perfection of a lunatic because he's an artist who hasn't the faintest idea what his artwork is or means. He's not restrained by such crude concepts as being or meaning. He's the vehicle of higher mysteries. He doesn't know how he created his work or why it just came out of him spontaneously, like vomit out of a drunkard. He did not think. He wouldn't stoop to thinking. He just felt it. All he has to do is feel. He feels, the flabby, loose-mouthed, shifty-eyed, drooling, shivering, uncongealed bastard. I, who know what discipline, what effort, what tension of mind, what unrelenting strain upon one's power of clarity are needed to produce a work of art, I, who know that it requires a labor which makes a chain gang look like rest, and a severity no army-drilling sadist could impose. I'll take the operator of a coal mine over any walking vehicle of higher mysteries. The operator knows that it's not his feelings that keep the coal carts moving under the earth, and he knows what does keep them moving. Feelings? Oh, yes, we do feel. He, you, and I. We are, in fact, the only people capable of feeling, and we know where our feelings come from. But what we did not know, and have delayed learning for too long, is the nature of those who claim that they cannot account for their feelings. We did not know what it is that they feel. We are learning it now. It was a costly error, and those most guilty of it will pay the hardest price, as in justice they must. Those most guilty of it were the real artists, who will now see that they are first to be exterminated, and that they had prepared the triumph of their own exterminators by helping to destroy their only protectors. For if there is more tragic a fool than the businessman who doesn't know that he's an exponent of man's highest creative spirit, it's the artist who thinks that the businessman is his enemy. It was true, she thought, when she walked through the streets of the valley, looking with a child's excitement at the shop windows sparkling in the sun, that the businesses here had the purposeful selectiveness of art, and that the art, she thought, when she sat in the darkness of a clabbered concert hall listening to the controlled violence and the mathematical precision of Halley's music, had the stern discipline of business. Both had the radiance of engineering, she thought, when she sat among rows of benches under the open sky, watching Kay Ludlow on the stage. It was an experience she had not known since childhood, the experience of being held for 3 hours by a play that told a story she had not seen before, in lines she had not heard, uttering a theme that had not been picked from the hand-me-downs of the centuries. It was the forgotten delight of being held in rapt attention by the reins of the ingenious, the unexpected, the logical, the purposeful, the new, and of seeing it embodied in a performance of superlative artistry by a woman playing a character whose beauty of spirit matched her own physical perfection. "That's why I'm here, Miss Taggart," said Kay Ludlow, smiling in answer to her comment after the performance. "Whatever quality of human greatness I have the talent to portray, that was the quality the outer world sought to degrade. They let me play nothing but symbols of depravity, nothing but harlots, dissipation chasers, and homewreckers, always to be beaten at the end by the little girl next door personifying the virtue of mediocrity. They used my talent for the defamation of itself. That was why I quit." Not since childhood, thought Dagny, had she felt that sense of exhilaration after witnessing the performance of a play, the sense that life held things worth reaching, not the sense of having studied some aspect of a sewer there had been no reason to see. As the audience filed away into the darkness from the lighted rows of benches, she noticed Ellis Wyatt, Judge Narragansett, Ken Daniger, men who had once been said to despise all forms of art. The last image she caught that evening was the sight of two tall, straight, slender figures walking away together down a trail among the rocks, with the beam of a spotlight flashing once on the gold of their hair. They were Kay Ludlow and Ragnar Danishold. And she wondered whether she could bear to return to a world where these were the two doomed to destruction. The recaptured sense of her own childhood kept coming back to her whenever she met the two sons of the young woman who owned the bakery shop. She often saw them wandering down the trails of the valley, two fearless beings, aged 7 and 4. They seemed to face life as she had faced it. They did not have the look she had seen in the children of the outer world, a look of fear, half secretive, half sneering, the look of a child's defense against an adult, the look of a being in the process of discovering that he is hearing lies, and of learning to feel hatred. The two boys had the open, joyous, friendly confidence of kittens who do not expect to get hurt. They had an innocently natural, non-boastful sense of their own value, and as innocent a trust in any stranger's ability to recognize it. They had the eager curiosity that would venture anywhere with the certainty that life held nothing unworthy of or closed to discovery. And they looked as if, should they encounter malevolence, they would reject it contemptuously, not as dangerous, but as stupid. They would not accept it in bruised resignation as the law of existence. "They represent my particular career, Miss Taggart," said the young mother in answer to her comment, wrapping a loaf of fresh bread and smiling at her across the counter. "They're the profession I've chosen to practice, which, in spite of all the guff about motherhood, one can't practice successfully in the outer world. I believe you've met my husband. He's the teacher of economics who works as linesman for Dick McNamara. You know, of course, that there can be no collective commitments in this valley, and that families or relatives are not allowed to come here unless each person takes the striker's oath by his own independent conviction. I came here not merely for the sake of my husband's profession, but for the sake of my own. I came here in order to bring up my sons as human beings. I would not surrender them to the educational systems devised to stunt a child's brain, to convince him that reason is impotent, that existence is an irrational chaos with which he's unable to deal, and thus reduce him to a state of chronic terror. You marvel at the difference between my children and those outside, Miss Taggart. Yet the cause is so simple. The cause is that here in Galt's Gulch there's no person who would not consider it monstrous ever to confront a child with the slightest suggestion of the irrational. She thought of the teachers whom the schools of the world had lost, when she looked at the three pupils of Dr. Axton on the evening of their yearly reunion. The only other guest he had invited was Kay Ludlow. The six of them sat in the backyard of his house, with the light of the sunset on their faces and the floor of the valley condensing into a soft blue vapor far below. She looked at his pupils, at the three pliant, agile figures half stretched on canvas chairs in poses of relaxed contentment, dressed in slacks, windbreakers, and open-collared shirts. John Galt, Francisco D'Anconia, Ragnar Danishold. "Don't be astonished, Miss Taggart," said Dr. Axton, smiling. "And don't make the mistake of thinking that these three pupils of mine are some sort of superhuman creatures. They're something much greater and more astounding than that. They're normal men, a thing the world has never seen, and their feat is that they've managed to survive as such. It does take an exceptional mind and a still more exceptional integrity to remain untouched by the brain-destroying influences of the world's doctrines, the accumulated evil of centuries. To remain human, since the human is the rational." She felt some new quality in Dr. Axton's attitude, some change in the sternness of his usual reserve. He seemed to include her in their circle, as if she were more than a guest. Francisco acted as if her presence at their reunion were natural, and to be taken gaily for granted. Galt's face gave no hint of any reaction. His manner was that of a courteous escort who had brought her here at Dr. Axton's request. She noticed that Dr. Axton's eyes kept coming back to her, as if with the quiet pride of displaying his students to an appreciative observer. His conversation kept returning to a single theme, in the manner of a father who has found a listener interested in his most cherished subject. "You should have seen them when they were in college, Miss Taggart. You couldn't have found three boys conditioned to such different backgrounds. But conditioners be damned! They must have picked one another at first sight among the thousands on that campus. Francisco, the richest heir in the world, Ragnar, the European aristocrat, and John, the self-made man, self-made in every sense, out of nowhere, penniless, parentless, tieless. Actually, he was the son of a gas station mechanic at some forsaken crossroads in Ohio, and he had left home at the age of 12 to make his own way. But I've always thought of him as if he had come into the world like Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, who sprang forth from Jupiter's head, fully grown and fully armed.